Welcome to another Podcast on Fire Network bonus episode on Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 1 and 2. And this is entirely selfish, because we have concluded our examination of the Young and Dangerous series and its spin-offs, most of them, if not all of them, on the regular show, Podcast on Fire. And it's greatly expanded my view of the series, both what I liked about it and what I didn't. Plus it cemented the fact that the spin-offs generally offered up more interesting material. And I had an appreciation of that before I even finished the main series, mainly through the Once Upon a Time in Triad Society films, and I'd seen Portland Street Blues as well. So there are solo episodes on these two films on the network where I talk about both of these films, which I'm sure are tolerable. But I'd like to hear someone else's take on these spin-off films, or one is a spin-off film for Francis M's ugly Quan character. And he was really one of the more memorable, if not the most memorable baddie of the series. So regardless of what he thinks of them, I'm going to try and sit back to a degree and let my YND series co-host Paul Fox share his review and analysis of Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 1 and 2. So say hello, buddy. It's nearly over.
Hello, and thank you for having me. This feels weird, being on a bonus episode. I think this is my, I'm losing my bonus episode virginity here.
Yeah, maybe so, but it's not a sort of you're relegated to the bonus section until you do well again. It's not that kind of thing. Thank you for taking part, and thank you for seeing through the Young and Dangerous coverage with me as we did. You know, 1 through 6, and then spin-offs, and then prequel, and then we were done. But I thought I'd start off with a little bit of a pop quiz. One question in my pop quiz. So, how many films in the Young and Dangerous universe does Francis appear in as Ugly Quan?
Oh, gosh. 3? If we are we counting this as... Are we counting Once Upon a Time in Triad Society as a quote-unquote Ugly Quan film?
Yes. Yes, we are.
4, I'm going to say.
Let's count here on my screen. You're right. You're absolutely right. Young and Dangerous, Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 1, Portland Street Blues, he had a cameo in that, and Young and Dangerous, the prequel, which he had a larger role in. There's actually also a 5th appearance that I haven't seen in the Lunar New Year comedy Twinkle Twinkle Lucky Star from 1996 by Wong Jing, that stars Nat Chan and Anita Yun. But judging by how that presents itself, it's not a Young and Dangerous little film that no one knows about. It's a Lunar New Year movie, and hey, you can cameo as that guy and sound like this a bit and talk like that. Great! Lunar New Year, Gong Hei Fat Choi, get out of here. I imagine it's a quickie. And I imagine you don't remember a single frame out of that 1996 Wong Jing movie.
If you I'm sure I've seen it. But no, it's not entirely memorable.
And I saw a picture of Francis, and it looked like they sort of put him in a suitable garish suit, and he had a little bit of a stubble, I guess. So it sure looked like an Ugly Quan walk on and quick walk off, I assume. But yeah, I wouldn't count that. Yeah, you're right. 4. At any rate, let's get into it. Once Upon a Time in Triad Society from 1996, and plot from the Love HK film review of the film goes as follows. So this features the return of Ugly Quan from Young and Dangerous 1, sort of. Francis plays Quan, a character who's exactly like the bad guy in Young and Dangerous, except it's not him. Think of this as Quan in an alternate universe. Anyway, Quan gets wounded in the film's opening sequence, and from then we begin to relive his life from his beginnings as a dopey wannabe triad to his future as a classically scummy triad boss. Along the way, we see how his character was shaped by betrayal, loss, and other soul-taxing events, most of them involving Loletta Lee, who seems older than usual, which is Koso's addition there. So, I don't know. Looks like wonderful Loletta or Rachel Lee to me. But yeah, this is the backstory of Ugly Quan. And before we let Paul talk here, let's talk a little bit about the director Chia Chun-Yi. I know nothing of his biography here, but I can only judge of what I see in his filmography. And His movies are a hit among some Hong Kong film aficionados. He had a short stint at Shaw Brothers with Journey of the Doom in 1985, which is really their last production year. But it's mainly the 90s work of Cha Chun-Yi that shines more brightly for me. Via category 3 movies such as Take Me with Veronica Yip. He did some further movies in that vein with that rating. One was The Rapist. Another was Legal Innocence, also starring Francis M. And that was based on the same true life crime that Clarence Fox movie Remains of a Woman was. Cha Chun-Yi also did the wild movie The Awakening, but primarily for me personally, my interest lies in his two Once Upon a Time in Triad Society movies, where I think the creativity was at its peak. We'll see what Paul thinks. And indeed, it opened in that big Young and Dangerous year of 1996. And remember, the first three films in the Young and Dangerous series opened in the same year. So it was a bit of a cultural touchstone, and they capitalized on the ball that got rolling through via the first movie. The series Young and Dangerous, that is, got off to a hot start with two movies already around the time when this came out in May. Two movies were already out in that series, but Triad Society 1 could not replicate the 19 to 20 million Hong Kong dollar box office that was indicative of Young and Dangerous 1 and 2 respectively, because Triad Society 1 only made a little over 4 million. You know, there was some interest perhaps in the supporting character from the main series, the big baddie, but not enough to rival the main series. The September release of Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 2 with a new character and storyline only made about 2 million as well. So these were small movies. But looking at these movies now, and with the series sort of in your head and what it was trying to do, what it did well, what it didn't do well, what it was criticized for, and then you know that there were many Triad movies at this time trying to sort of capitalize on the ball that Windy started rolling. So do you think, personally, if director Cha Chun-Yi and his writer Rico Chung were looking at the feel and content of the main series and saw an opportunity to play with tropes, to do a satirical take on them? Or, you know, could you spot if their concern was that this lifestyle was looking way too cool and we need to kind of make it dumb, but also cinematic and try and come up with an angle for our story? So what's your take on that?
It's hard to say. I mean, it doesn't feel like that they were allowed to officially play in the YND universe, mm-hmm. because when you look at, for example, even the Chinese title makes no reference to Guokzai, the name of the Young and Dangerous series in Chinese. And just based on that, and based on the fact that as we get into the narrative and talk about how this is, in fact, a divergence from the Ugly Quan character, it feels like something like they took something almost like what was done with James Bond in the film Casino Royale. Yes, Casino Royale is an actual Ian Fleming novel, but when they made the one with David Niven, not the new one, back in the day, it was really not a James Bond movie. It wasn't part of the James Bond canon, if you will, but it was kind of a spoof of James Bond. So I kind of got the sense that was what they were doing, that maybe they didn't have an official license to go in with the property and do stuff, but they saw an opportunity to take a fairly popular character and play with him a little bit.
And before we get further on, prior experiences and experiences prior to recording of watching Cha Chun-Yi's movies, which are adult in nature for a good stretch in the 90s, anything in particular that stands out, positive or negative for you?
I'm not super up on the Category 3 genre as much as that sleazy K guy might be. I've seen quite a few of his titles over the years, but more on the non-Category 3 side. So the ones that kind of stick out for me is you know, sort of his romantic comedy with Fren Chan and Ching Mei Yao called Mr. Fortune from 1989. You get into stuff that you've talked about, though, like The Rapist, which is a Category 3 film, but it's one that's approachable for me because it's based on actual case out of Hong Kong.
The Tuen Mun rapist.
Yeah. So, I mean, you get this from time to time. So, like, more recently, you had the film Port of Call, starring Aaron Kwok, which was also a quote-unquote Category 3 film because of the, you know, some of the content involved and, you know, also based on a real case, right? So Hong Kong cinema is known for doing this. So at times they have these films pop up. And I think that that's a very interesting film for somebody who's interested in not just Hong Kong cinema, but also sort of Hong Kong history, you know, more current history and the way that kind of gets portrayed on screen. That's a film worth tracking down. I have seen Take Me before, which is the one with Veronica Yip. I saw, and she's always a fun actor, whether she's doing, you know, a fun presence on the screen, whether she's doing Category 3 or just, you know, regular movies. She's somebody who I think if you find Hong Kong cinema entertaining, you will always find her presence very entertaining on screen.
She's not a bad actress. She managed to break out of the Category 3 mold and get some and perform well in some more challenging material. And you know, it might not sound like it, but Call Girl 92, it wasn't a Category 3 movie, and it was a worthwhile dramatic take on the hostess movie, shot in sync sound as well, and she's in that lovely movie A Roof with a View with Big Tony that I really enjoyed. Yeah. As well, so she's one of those examples that managed to get out of it, so to say, and brand herself a little bit differently.
If the one thing I'll say about the director is as you look at his work, he's kind of all over the place, and I do get the sense that he was maybe seen as a director who could kind of go in and get the job done, but he never really developed a singular style, you know, because again, he's working across genres, romantic comedies. You've got these triad films that he's doing. You've got films like The Rapist, some Category 3 films. And then even later, you know, in his later filmography, you've got films like Fall for You, a more modern romantic comedy with Francis M. and Christy Young, which is okay. I didn't have a chance to go back and revisit it, but I remember that it wasn't one that really jumped out at me at the time when I saw it, because I think Francis Yu has another one from this period called Bakery Amour with Michelle Reyes, which is it's a much better and more interesting romantic comedy from the era. And I think this one, his film Fall for You, kind of fell short of that mark a little bit. And then he has a kids film called Super Kid from 2006 with Gordon Lamb. That this is an interesting film. I never saw it, and it's one that was always on the shelves whenever I'd go into the DVD shops, and I was like, should I get this? Nah, I'll get it another time, you know, because it was one that was always ever present. You can tell by just looking at the cover of it, you know, it's like, yep, see, I've seen that cover. And I just never picked it up. And now, of course, you know, it's like,
good luck.
Nowhere to be found.
Well, I still have the disc, but I don't have the cover anymore, but I still have the disc. I bought it back in the day. It was a touching movie. It had kids elements. I think it was kind of inappropriate for kids in some areas.
As most Hong Kong kids films are.
Yeah, maybe a little bit scary at points. I remember at one point in dialogue, and I don't remember the context now, but they do reference Men Behind the Sun in the dialogue, which is a deep cut for people who are into graphic cult movies. And
one that's not easy to explain to your children as you're sitting in the
exactly
theater
with them. What does that mean? Men behind a sun. Are they driving a sun? And I'm driving a sun and they're behind it. No, it's not about that. Not that kind of sun. But yeah but you're right. I mean, if any like consistent quality and style and dedication to theme is present, it's in these two movies, because it, in my eyes, tries to break down triad tropes. It isn't doing straight-faced triad tropes like A Young and Dangerous or any random movie from 1996 or 97.
Now, one question I have for you, Kenneth, is that because you are just wrapping up your series on Michael Wong, which I think is titled Wong or Wrong.
Wong, totally Wong.
Yeah, and he actually directed Michael Wong in a film from 1997 called Theft Under the Sun. Have you guys covered that one?
Not covered. I have seen it. It's been a while. it wasn't an action effort that stood out to me as such. Didn't linger with me. I think Julian Cheung is in it, which might be another reason why it doesn't linger as such. I'm not a great fan of Julian. Might have been a little bit too big for the workhorse of a director. Maybe not ready for the action. Maybe being part of Hong Kong action cinemas, it didn't really stick with me as such. But I'm a billion years old and I'm too acceptable of most movies. So if I rewatch it again, I'm gonna go like, yeah, it's okay.
One thing I will point out about the director, though, is that in addition to his directorial filmography, he's also worked in quite a few roles: producer, second unit director, executive producer, especially on films that I think people would be more familiar with, like Men Suddenly in Black from 2003. But he's also got actually more credits as an actor. Now, I say this actor in quotes because I think more often than not, it's a case of them sticking him in, you know, as an extra in places or very small roles as you look down the list. But stuff that I think people should be familiar with as you go down the list. I mean, One Night in Mongkok, Mermaid Got Married. Okay, go Egan. Mermaid film, gotta love that film. Inspectors Wear Skirts 4, right? So there's definitely titles in there. One of my favorite romantic comedies from the 80s, Happy Together. Not That Happy Together, you Wong Kar Wai fans, but
you are very quick and defensive about that.
But yeah, charming little film with Kenny B and Cherie Chung that I've always admired. He's kind of in a lot of places that I think fans would recognize. In sort of other roles. And I get the sense that he was really somebody who was, he was not out to be an actor, but he's somebody who's kind of working behind the scenes and probably was easy to get a hold of and say, hey, you know, jump in here. I think that's something that a lot of people who tend to be in crew positions often end up getting the call for, getting the tap for, if they have a decent screen presence. You know, they'll stick them in a small role here or there.
So let's hear you share your thoughts on Once Upon a Time in Tri Society. And by the way, how does what context? I've not seen it until now because I never read the Chinese titles for obvious reasons. What's the context of fitting the English word of fit into the Chinese title? Can you even break that down?
Okay, so as I understand it, and again, this is a little bit of slang going on here, so I'm not an expert on Cantonese slang, but basically the Chinese title is Mong Kok Joy Fit Yan, which basically means the most fit, okay, person. And in colloquial terms, because it becomes sort of a compound phrase, basically it means like the top person or the best, you know, the most capable, or, you know, the one who should be the leader, basically, of Mong Kok, right? So it's a term that, you know, you use to basically refer to somebody who's gonna, you know, born to be king, to put it in dangerous terms, right?
It wouldn't be out of line for something Ugly Kwan would aspire to this and would be kind of boastful about that. Like, sure. I'm born for this. So
yeah,
and if you're in my way, then I'll try and break a bottle over your head. But anyway, let's get to your thoughts, and I'll ask some questions if I have them, because I've shared my thoughts and I rate it quite highly. But what about you?
To understand things that draw me to something is I love good narrative and I love stuff that has connective tissue. So going into this and you know, back when I first saw it, I was like, okay, I'm gonna get an Ugly Kwan, you know, backstory, because we've gotten backstories from other things before. So I'm like, yeah. And then I'm like, wait, what? You know, you get to that midway point, you're like, wait, what?
We're getting another story.
What are they doing? Okay. And now, okay, so now this is the real story. Okay. And then you get to the end and you're like, wait, what? It's like, okay, so this isn't actually Ugly Kwan from Earth 1. This is Ugly Kwan from Earth 2, if I can make a stupid DC reference or something. And I guess the first time I saw it, I was very, very disappointed that they ended up doing that, because I wanted to see the actual backstory of Ugly Kwan, you know, from the Y&D universe.
Isn't it feasible that his backstory would play out in one case here? Because there are two versions of it present in this movie.
It is feasible, yes. And in fact, I kind of, you know, but I was hopeful. I wanted to see, one of the Y&D boys, maybe not Jerry Lamb, but one of them show up at a certain point, or
they could afford a Jerry Lamb,
Brother
I'm sure.
B or somebody, because I didn't really get any of that. I think the first time I watched this, I just kind of was like, okay, it was not that high on my list. I think rewatching it this time gave me a slightly different perspective, and I appreciated it more as a sort of commentary on the series, especially having gone through all of the films kind of in sequence, where we've seen, where they've diverged narratively, or they've diverged from an aesthetic sense because you've got different directors, and we've seen how, some films are better than others because they took creative chances. And so I think the creative chances that they've taken here made me appreciate it a bit more with a second viewing, much more so that when I first watched it, kind of just off on its own back in the day.
Yeah, because granted, it's easy, I think, to sell this maybe in a playful way as part of the Young and Dangerous universe. But if you are playful about it, you're referencing the fact that he is Ugly Quan or Brother Quan. No wonder people who know the series up to this point are expecting that. So it's a minefield, I suppose.
I would have loved to have been an actual audience member back in the day when this was released and just kind of walk out of the theater and listen to, what the audience, how the audience took it at the time.
Where was Eakin?
Yeah. Because I'm not sure how it would have been received. And they did a sequel, but it was, within a very quick time span. So I don't know if it was based on box office. This one did better box office numbers than the sequel, but I don't think it was, it wasn't gangbuster box office business.
Do you remember the opening scene with Ridley Choi and as a very heroic triad, a Japanese triad, and the very stylish triad brawl that follows, that then gets revealed to be part of a comic book? Is that spoof to you? Is that satirical because of how Ugly Quan, he reviews what he's reading and he thinks it's nonsense. He thinks it's hyped up nonsense that someone is portraying himself as way too heroic in this comic book. And he puts a period on that review by wiping his butt with one of the pages. That sounds broad, but if you look at that sequence in itself, do you think they're poking fun at that these stories are way too boastful and heroic?
Yeah, I mean, you understand that Young and Dangerous came from comic books, so in a sense, it would be like, somebody doing, and there are shows that actually do this now, but, they kind of deconstruct the superhero image, but somebody, saying, showing a scene from like Superman or Captain America and something, and then saying, oh, that's not how heroes really are, and then it's that kind of attitude that they're going at it. And I think it does work well because you do get some of that that overt heroic aspect, even in the Young and Dangerous films. Is it really pushing that idea out there that, being in the triad is this heroic ideal, too much? And that was certainly something that a lot of critics were talking about back in this era.
Yeah, it's very timely to a few months after Young and Dangerous had hit and become a box office hit to have this scene here. Granted, this wasn't seen widely, but I think being in 1996, you can see it as a response to the fact that it isn't all, it's sort of smoke and mirrors here, and things aren't that heroic, doesn't need to be that heroic. Not that Ugly Quan is, because he's on a streak there early in the movie, isn't he, in terms of killing and heinous behavior and sending people off elsewhere as punishment for, I laugh because I think he's a force here. He's a whirlwind in the early going. If you remember what he does to to Farini Chung's family and her.
Yeah, he's not a nice guy. I mean, and that's been established. And so they take the very interesting approach of saying, well, we're gonna try to show you how he got to point B from point A, right? And then they give you this very kind of almost romantic comedy-esque kind of backstory that, it's interesting because you really want to know, how did he get from this guy to the guy we know, right? And then they kind of pull the rug out from under you.
Yeah, and don't worry about spoiling that, by the way. It's sort of mid-movie. I think I spoiled it in my discussion, but perhaps we'll get to that. Random question off the top of your head. this particular Francism acting persona, the wild one, the quirky one, who clearly sinks his teeth into this one as well. Is that more appealing to you, or do you like when he plays it a bit more serious and brooding a la Full Alert, Inferno Affairs 2, or is there appealing both even?
I like the Ugly Quan character. I do think he was kind of pushed over the top here to overemphasize the villainous of the character. I think he was portrayed perhaps as a smarter character in the Windy films. And I know that's done for effect, right? It's especially for the first segment, you know, it's the first bit of storytelling. It's to try and show the contrast between that first flashback character and the character he is now. And the thing that my big takeaway was that it was really almost like a nature versus nurture kind of thing, right? You have these two origin stories. One is kind of like, well, he was a product of his environment and the way he was treated by other people that turned him into the Ugly Quan character from this nice guy. And then the second story is more like, nope, he was just born bad.
That summary is what I've personally always found hysterical for some reason. It's not the original, of course. Movies have done this. Subsequent Hong Kong movies, even involving Francism, have done this. If you remember, Too Many Ways to Be Number One also had a, you know, if you go this way, this happens. If you go this way, that happens. And of course, Western movies like Sliding Doors, Run Lola Run, that came out around the same time or a year after. So, but I always found that hysterical that they chose the comedic path they did. And then, you know, really played with us to sort of make us feel like, yeah, you can get destroyed and eaten up and spat out in this tried society. This is what happens, people. And then that midpoint comes, it's like, no. I was born evil, and one of my favorite lines in the movie, it's funny to be a triad. And it doesn't that say everything you need to know, and I'm sure that doesn't tickle anyone but me. But it so does. It may not be a work of genius, it may not be a work of great satire, but I think it's so hysterical that they run with that angle, and that works for me.
I think there's definitely a subtlety to it that's maybe lost on a general audience. I think, you know, when you think about playing with the triad genre, especially from this era, I mean, you're drawn to films like Days of Being Dumb or Boys Are Easy, you know, Triad Olympics and yes, things like that, which is really, but it's really, you know, kind of going over the top. It's not balancing that line that I think they're going for here, which takes quite a bit of nuance to do. And I do think they're successful here in doing that, but I think maybe it wasn't widely recognized by the audience at the time. And I do wonder if they had this idea, you know, going forward, because one of the things that we've talked about in going over the series, you know, that's always been kind of a sticking point for me is, you get these villains, not necessarily Ugly Quan, but some of the villains that follow in the Y&D films that are these kind of like really over the top evil bad guys. They're so evil for the sake of being evil, and they lack the Ugly Quan nuance and characterization that you got in the first film, but they have to outdo him because these are subsequent films. And then it does beg the question, is like, how did they ever get there?
You know, to be fair, Paul, the series only had two villains, the one that Francis M plays and the rest that Roy Chung played multiple times. Just fill it
and
out
actually,
with Roy.
I mean, I'm sure that there's an academic paper out there waiting to explain to us why Jerry Lamb is the actual villain of the whole series.
If you look at him and then played backwards, and maybe it will work out. Just random questions off the top of my head. Is his vocal performance any fun to have for an entire movie, or is it for some reason grating to you? Because
see, that's the thing. It wasn't the whole movie. I mean, because he's the handsome, you know, naive kid who kind of, you know, just gets betrayed by his buddies and then has to, you know, what is it they established that he swims back to Hong Kong?
Yeah, he floats back to Hong Kong from Japan, and then his voice is changed. So
that made me laugh.
It's like, where am I? You're in Hong Kong, stupid. And then when he realizes, like, oh, this is my playground now. I love that sort of smile on Francis's face.
But look, let's put this into context. I mean, this is a film doing what Christopher Nolan would do later with The Joker, right? Where it's like, you know, the famous thing about Heath Ledger's Joker was that he gave no true origin, right? He made up all, like, several different stories about how he became what he was, and that left him kind of enigmatic, right? They're doing that with the Ugly Quan character here, which I think is really, you know, it's an interesting way to play with the character. It just stinks that it's not actually the character. I mean, I think it, with a minor change at the end of this movie, they could have just kept it as the character, you know. It's like,
yeah. The only real prequel story was literally in Young and Dangerous, the prequel, and I don't think they connected the dots or finalized that loop very well. Because one of my criticisms for Young and Dangerous, the prequel, which was a period episode set in 1989, was that nothing looked like 1989, including Francis, who just turned up. It looked like from home, looking sharp as he always did. And it really didn't look like some costume effort was put into it all. I mean, it's fun to see him; he's a dick, but and we could hear that voice in sync sound. But it really didn't give us anything. So we're still missing, like, of course, the true backstory in Earth, Young and Dangerous Earth One, of course. But at least this one tickles me, you know. So it's more satisfying than what we got from Andrew Lau. And any fun cameos for you? Was it fun seeing Hong Kong of whatever area they were in, circa 1996, being looked like a pretty active area they were shooting in there. So
you do get a couple of people here. I mean, Edmund So as his buddy Grasshopper, and you can also see people like, you know, Paul. I think Pauline Chan is there as the nurse in a fairly small role. But I was expecting to see some of the regular, you know, gangsters of note when I first watched. And of course, obviously we know that didn't happen, but you do get Michael Chan, right? Chan Wai-man, who's got a pretty significant role here. So he's always fun as well.
And of course, Spencer Lam, like everything is different from Young and Dangerous, but he's still a priest, kind of.
Which again, you know, like, first time I'm watching this, I'm like going, wait a minute, that means Ugly Quan is Karen Mok's brother? What? So yeah, the connective tissue successfully cut, especially with they end up killing him. He ends up killing his dad or something.
Yep, they have a little gag with unbreakable bottles and some nasty... some nasty head wounds left and right here. So, was it fun to see them running around in crowded streets, getting the shots they could, and amping the authenticity of granted a goofy movie.
It is what it is for the era, for sure. And Hong Kong has certainly changed a lot. One of the other cameos probably worth mentioning is Samuel Moon, Leung Chae Moon, who manages to show up in a lot of these, just as completely different characters all the time. I guess he was just kind of, on hand.
You might think that he is like this, for lack of a better word, like bad actor. Just turns up in like small roles here and there. Looks a bit goofy. He's in Naked Poison, but he really is an accomplished actor. But you have to see other movies for his dramatic range. I remember really liking it was a sort of youth prison movie called Lost Boys in Wonderland. There he's really good in it. It's before this one though, but yeah, he was available left and right to do these movies and have quite different roles in this one versus Triad Society 2. In this one, he's the big one of the big bad triad bosses that does gnarly things to Edmund So, and in part two is it can be rattled a bit more easily in part two, if you will. So, but yeah, anything else you want to talk about that tickled you or interested you or didn't interest you, as a matter of fact?
You know, I would say that if this is one you can get access to, because of, you know, its availability is still an issue, though it may end up on Blu-ray any day now.
Right about 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. There it is. I'm just seeing the announcement.
If this is one you can get access to, I'd say, you know, watch the first Young and Dangerous film just to get a sense of the character, and then I think you'll appreciate this film more. But you don't need to watch anything else. And really, this film is a standalone film, but you should have a clear understanding of where the character came from, even though this is, you know, as we said, like an Earth 2 character. Oh, we should probably also throw a little bit of credit. Rachel Lee, Loretta Lee, Lee Lai-chan, who's here as the love interest.
She's in, I'd forgotten about this. She has three roles in this film. One, as the restaurant worker, Ugly Kwan is, or Brother Kwan is so in love with. Then, and this is, it's a spoiler, I guess, but this is a gag. I didn't appreciate if it even is a gag. Because this is Ugly Kwan telling his story. And his first story, the first half of the movie, concludes with him going to Japan and learning Japanese and working a food stall. And he's married a Japanese wife, presumably. His dream wife. It's still Rachel Lee. It's still Loretta Lee.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, of course it's her. Because in his mind, as he tells this story, which turns out to be false, he can't make up anyone else. That's sort of his embodiment of the dream woman. So he's in his as he tells it in his haze, as he's almost is dying. That'll be her too, and it might not sound. It's not a riot. Oh my god, it's her! But it tickled me as well. That yeah, that's her, and she's on the TV as well, is she? When he calls into the sort of self-help program or advice program that she's on, and he calls her up and he gets closer to the TV and then calls her a bitch for no reason. Yeah. Then hangs up. So I think that was her as well. So I counted three Rachels.
Yeah, the Japanese sequence is interesting because I think that is really there as a kind of a, it takes you back to the beginning when that whole sort of idealized Japanese gangster attack is happening. And then it kind of ends up rehappening in a similar way to him at that temple. So that's a fairly clear tell that there's some chicanery going on with his storytelling. So,
but it's almost a little subtle gag to cast her, and they don't make a big deal out of introducing her with a close up. But I've seen the movie a bunch of times, and granted, it's a Laserdisc, so it's not 1080p or whatever. But still, wait a minute. That was her, wasn't it? And it's not because they couldn't find anyone. That's because they wanted it to be that way. That's pretty funny. I can understand why that's funny. So that worked for me. So even this viewing, I found some new stuff to latch onto. But otherwise, if you didn't have any other notes, I'll do... Well, it's the availability for both of the movies, really, because they're in the same situation. So anything else you wanted to say before I do that?
No, I think that wraps it up for my thoughts.
So for the moment, this may change in a week. And the availability applies to Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 2 as well. One has been available on VCD and Laserdisc and probably VHS 2 by Maya. And Fitto Mobile did part 2 on VCD and Laserdisc. It never got a local DVD release by Whitesight or whatever. We did have a DVD release, I believe, of part 2 in Malaysia a few years ago. That was a subtitled letterbox version, but it might have been the cinema print, only with added optional subtitles for its market. But I'm sure that's pretty hard to get. But we're going to hope dearly for a Blu-ray reissue in the future. May our titles, I don't think, are dead and buried necessarily. I think they're in circulation, so hopefully we can see both these movies, maybe not in a two-pack or anything, but I think the future is brighter for catalog titles on Hong Kong Blu-ray, and that would include this one, because if sort of low rent category 3 movies like Horrible High Heels can get a category 3 Blu-ray release, then anything can happen. So I hope it does happen to both of these movies personally. So
yeah, give us a box set with an unbreakable bottle.
Exactly. That would be what the sort of South Korean tactic for limited edition. They had it down, that technique down, when crafting limited editions back in the day of DVDs. You know, like My Sassy Girl had like an egg. The whole package was an egg. That applies to the movie. So they knew that stuff. Even Save the Green Planet, I don't know if you've seen that, but there's a scene with this menthol rub, this alcohol rub that you put on your skin to heal, but they use it as a torture device. They included that in the limited edition DVD for Save the Green Planet. So
I got a limited edition version of Lover's Pajamas. It gave me a little packet of laundry detergent.
You'll treasure that just as much as Scrooge McDuck treasures his first ever dollar or cent or whatever. So, good on you. We'll take a break, and Paul is will be back to talk to us about Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 2. So I'm going to quiz him on, not quiz him, but ask questions if I have them. But I'll lean back as I hopefully did during this first half. But regardless, we're going to take a music break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back, and for the second half of this bonus episode, Paul is going to share his thoughts on Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 2. This is from the same director and writer and star, but is not another ugly Kwan movie. This is completely unconnected from the Young and Dangerous universe. It is only connected in the fact that it's a Triad film, but it presents itself in a different way, I suppose. But let's get into it. Some plot from Love HK Films review of the film. Francis plays a wimpy triad named Dagger who talks big but has a huge yellow streak. He'd rather play Mahjong, but he's called to attend a potential gang fight. Official triad actor Roy Cheung is Dinosaur, a member of the rival triad, but he's a friend of Dagger's, whose faithful girlfriend, played by Ada Choi, tags along too much. And Cheung Tat-ming is an anti-triad cop who tries to prevent the fight while attempting to save his marriage at the same time. As the designated time approaches, all these threads begin to move towards their resolutions, which can only happen when knife fights finally break out in the streets. I may have rated it high. That doesn't mean the entire world it does. So let's hear Paul's starting thoughts on Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 2.
Before offline, we were talking a little bit about the title here. The Chinese title, again, also no reference to Young and Dangerous. And I think this film is like completely removed from any notion of the Young and Dangerous-ness of anything, because it's a completely separate story. But here, too, you've got a similar title to Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 1, but it's slightly different. Basically, the Cantonese is like Hoi Ba Jia Fit Yan Bing Chun, which basically is, you've got that idea of Jia Fit Yan, which we talked about, meaning like the most fit person. But this is now like, go the most fit army. And I think that's, again, deciphering Cantonese slang, especially from the 90s, is not something I can do easily. But I think it's basically talking about like the fitness, because what this story is it's about a knight kind of down in Kowloon side, Mongkok area, I'm guessing, without getting place specific. It's an afternoon and an evening where you've got these two big rival gang sides, you know, building up and the tension. So you've got these two big kind of, you know, street armies that are potentially going to face off. So I think that's what the Chinese title is kind of referring to here. With the English title, again, being Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 2, you think, oh, it's carryover from 1? No, completely separate story. I don't think there's any linkage in terms of the gangs or the characters or anything. There are a couple names that are mentioned here. So, for example, at one point, Roy Cheung is on the phone, and his character's name is Dinosaur, Hong Long, or Dinosaur. That's a name that we've seen used in the Young and Dangerous movies before for another unrelated character. And that character was not played by Roy Cheung, amazingly enough. It was a separate, a different actor too. When he's on the phone, I think he calls K Go, right? Brother K, who's could be a reference, you know, but again, that actor doesn't show up and, you know, it's just, you know, he's talking to somebody unknown in the phone. So really, I mean, this has no correlation or connection to the first Triad Society film or to any of the Y&D films.
You,
so
you can literally watch it even before Triad Society 1.
It's a completely standalone film and a standalone experience. That being said, as a triad film, it's not overly unusual. I mean, it's kind of telling the story of these low-level members. It has some good elements, but my problem is that there's really three stories here that are going on in the course of this afternoon and evening. And those stories end up taking focus that there's not enough time spent because it's a 90-minute movie. There's not enough time spent with any of the characters to really make any of them, even Frances Ng's character, who perhaps gets a slight bit more of screen time than anybody else. But I just didn't spend enough time with him to really be that invested in him or his relationship with Ivy Leung or his friends or any of the other characters. And then the separate stories you've got going with Ada Choi and Roy Chung, and then the police officer played by Chung Tat Meng just didn't, didn't really gel with me.
That's certainly true that it's not like it's Three-Hour Magnolia type of movie where these threads intersect and they spend some time on it. That's very much true. What I've always walked away with, and if I rate this the same as the first one, I can't really compare the two. I would give them the same grade, but I can't say that this is better than the other because, as you said, it's a completely different story. What I always walked away with is that I enjoy that these character camps, if we focus on Francis and Roy specifically, one is avoidance at all costs, and one is I want action at all costs. I'll do anything. I'll go anywhere. And that really sat well with me, and has always sat well with me. That the Francis's character, he talks a big game, and he can hold court and say the big things, but he's clearly just a big, big old coward that would rather just stay on the outskirts. Why he has picked this life? Well, maybe financially gainful because there's nothing else in this life. But he's certainly not living up to the triad oath that presumably he's been asked to take at one point. And Roy Chung is missing the action. He's preparing for it. He's buff and he's ready. He sharpens his weapons and there's nothing happening. As you said, the scene on the phone I find very funny and interesting that he's calling all his contacts, his brothers, his bosses, that do you have any job for me? And after the fifth or sixth call, he's calling the same guy again. Like, did I call you? You sure? And I found that they established between those two in particular unusual. I don't see that as personally, but I've forgotten most movies that I've seen in my life, but I don't see that as something that movies have already worn out and tropes that have been done to death. So I found that quite fresh that you have an anti-triad and someone who is just desperate to do triad stuff and quite recklessly as well, you could argue, because he wants danger, and the danger that's looming is not play, it's lethal, at least for those two. Maybe not so much Chung Tat Min's story as the cop, but I think these two, the way they pull in different directions, I think is fairly fresh for a triad movie, especially at this time when we were where this was the year of Young and Dangerous, and the more you played with this, the more you were sort of the anti-triad movie, the more I liked to glance at movies, if you know what I mean.
For me, it comes down to some of the tropes they relied on. On the one hand, you've got sort of the relationship between Ada Choi and Roy Chung, where Ada Choi is really kind of this clingy, overly naive girlfriend who just wants to follow him into danger. And I mean, she almost kills Samuel Leung again, Leung Chak-moon, who's here again in a different role, almost accidentally kills him when they're playing around with knives. I mean, I was most interested in Francis's character as Dagger and kind of his relationship with other people, like
And he's very special. He's very special gang that I don't know if that's his gang or just his friends, because as we were about to say, the they have an elderly buddy.
Their rapport was interesting, and they spend some time sitting around just kind of playing mahjong, trying to stay out of the action. When they're sitting around, like for example, playing mahjong, I was very much reminded of Patrick Kong movies, where a lot of times in his films, he just has characters sitting around playing mahjong, kind of bantering back and forth. That's something that he's used quite frequently. And so I like that. I kind of wanted to see more of that, you know. And I guess for some people, especially for a triad film, they would think that's boring. But I think that's when this film was really more appealing for me, because we're getting more insights into, you know, Francis M's character
and the way he holds court as well. Like he rattles off, you know, trying to convince his mahjong table friends that might not be his friends at that point, there might be other players, that he's, you know, I know this, I know that, and that right character, he's, you know, I look up to him, and I have all these contacts, and I'm so brave. And they're like, just play. Yeah. Talking and just play. And with his friends, he doesn't need to do that. He doesn't need to talk a big game, which speaks to a little bit to an insecurity close to being found out that he's a little bit of a fraud. And he obviously has no great ties to his family either. So he's out there swimming without a you know, life vest in a way.
Yeah. So you know, when it shifts to Chen Tameng, who's this, you know, basically he's just the henpecked husband. We've seen that kind of, you know, character type before. You know, he's henpecked husband, but he really loves his wife kind of thing. Yeah, as I talked about the Ada Choi and sort of Roy Chung dynamic. So bouncing around between these three groups over the course of the evening, it's a fine strategy. I just don't think they committed enough time. I think they needed 10, 15 minutes more to play with that kind of strategy to get more out of these characters, especially, I mean, because one of the threads ends way early in the scope of the whole movie because of something that happens, really. And really you don't end up going back to that at all. And then the second thread kind of ends at the end. But then really the longest thread is with Francis M's character. That's kind of how it seems like the screenwriter wanted this film centered, but again, they just spend so much time bouncing around. And this is stuff, I mean, they've done stuff like this before. You think about movies that take place over the course of an evening, PTU, One Night in Mongkok, right? They've kind of approached this better. But I think one thing that this film does really well is the sense of tension on the street that builds as these two gangs start to show up over the course of the afternoon and evening, the police trying to get ready for it.
It's a really nice intercut in between all these factors looking in. And I agree that tension was really cool. You could have even do without the ticking clock aspect, but I guess, you know, it's there for clarity. We know 10 p.m. it's going to kick off. And without spoiling it, this movie does turn serious, and I think it does that certainly well. It's almost prophetically heartbreaking the way what we find out about Francis later in the movie. But what I was going to tell you, the most hysterical bit in this movie is how the triad brawl kicks off, which is complete accident, and it's of course Dagger's fault that this happens. And I find that hysterical, that the accidental triad brawl, which this movie has tonal whiplash, it really does, and you're either on board with that or you're not, because that is funny, but the movie is more serious in the second half, and for me it succeeds, maybe not as much in the Roy Chung Ada Choi relationship, because you're right, they aren't fleshed out as such, but the way we follow through on Francis, the more he sinks deeper into this mess, and the more we find out about the lack of family ties, which makes his character just it's not heart-wrenching, it's not funny, it's just kind of pathetic and sad that he is in the predicament he is, you know, whether it's his fault or not. But what I was getting to as well, the tonal whiplash from sort of goofy funny, just hanging out at the mahjong table, then to deadly seriousness. Do you think they navigated that somewhat well?
Yeah, I mean, I think basically, given where the film ends up, I think that tonal shift does, you know, it does work, it does play out, because you don't want to, if you go too silly, then again, you get, you know, Boys Are Easy, or you get more of a parody, right? That kind of, and I don't think that's what they were trying to go for. But I don't think they wanted this to be, you know, overly dark. They didn't want this to be like Election 2 or something. So I think that they were trying to keep it light, but they went more serious when they needed to. I do like the fact that, you know, you do have Francis as kind of this anti ugly Quan, you know, again, showing how he's able to really be diverse.
And even by the way, when he's talking a big game, he's not convincing in the least, and he's not acting like he's threatening. He's just trying to talk like he's some kind of authority. And whenever he like, oh God, when he joins his buddies an hour before the fight, and he needs to act along with them, and he's like, yay, we're going to fight now, isn't this wonderful, and you just know that he hates every second of what's going on, and he isn't putting on a great show at that point either. I'm surprised he wasn't kicked to the curb earlier in his trial life, because at points he isn't very convincing as Dagger the Act, if you will. That means it's great, and I love watching Francis navigate those that minefield and going in with a sort of secure, cocksure mind, and they're being totally insecure about what's going to happen, and at one point just kind of giving up because there's no way back.
It's not an easy thing to try and navigate what they were doing. Again, when you're trying to create a film that, you know, evokes tension, that's going to have some violence in it. I'm not sure I really totally agree with how the film ended in terms of the sort of lighter nature of the sentence that is given. But I mean, I get what they were going for with trying to get Francis's character out of a hole, in a sense, that he had dug himself into. But here, too, that's another trope that has been done and continues to be done in other triad style narratives, where it's like you've got the guy who's reluctant, you know, and then he's given the task of going out to basically do a hit job. He doesn't want to do the job. His buddies are not really his buddies, because basically they're forcing him to do the job. And if he doesn't do the job, they're going to do it on him, kind of a thing. Even this year, okay, so TVB has a drama series called Armed Reaction 2021. Stars Moses Chan. And Heem Law is one of the actors. He plays a young triad guy. And it's a light sort of TVG, you know, comedy drama kind of thing. But he's in the same situation, you know, and he's a low-level triad member, and his boss basically asks him to go put a hit out on this rival guy, and he doesn't want to do it. And he's got like 24 hours to do it, and it's like, how is he going to get out of it? And he's trying to weasel his way out of it. And so that's, again, a very sort of common plot trope to have. Where you have a low-level character who, you know, gets by, you know, because I mean, Francis's character, his name's Dagger, but he's not really a fighter. He's a pimp, basically. You know, he just...
Of one.
Yeah.
Which might not make him come off as a very likable guy, because he's a pimp after all. He runs a small prostitution ring, but the movie isn't making this grand statement about him mistreating his sole... mainland prostitute here or anything. So it's what triads do, including Dagger. He has at least one, and but he's also a progressive sort of triad, because he allows Li Qingyan to dress up as a woman if he likes it, because they're just gonna play mahjong anyway, so who cares if he's in drag or not. So a little bit more extended role for the nose-picking transvestite from all those Stephen Chow movies. Li Qingyan is in this movie for a bit longer than you're used to, if you're used to seeing Stephen Chow movies. And he doesn't get beat up for being a transvestite, like what happens often in Stephen Chow movies. It sounds horrible, but...
He does get beat up, though, but not for that.
Yeah. Was it appealing again to see Francis sort of lead this, sink his teeth... into this one, because I think around this time he began to find go on a role in my eyes, getting very appealing roles for a number of years ahead. Granted, I didn't see him in his wild roles before. My first encounters with him was through Bullets Over Summer and Juliet in Love, which are much more dramatic roles with some quirks, but I'd never seen really the wild side of him until the Triad Society, the first one, and I always found him very appealing as a leading man, and very versatile, and can go through those wild, quirky moments to more scary villains akin to Full Alert, as I mentioned in the first half. So I don't know if this is, feels like reference material Francis Mfoy, but was it on the whole appealing seeing him lead?
I like him when he's more downplayed and a bit more approachable and less over the top in roles like this. We talked about before, you know, as a romantic lead in things like Bakery Amour, where he's also much more downplayed. I think that's the thing that I prefer. Even in Once Upon a Time in Triad Society 1, the first story, I prefer that. I prefer the nice guy, Francis, as opposed, I mean, Ugly Quan is a great character, but I like him more when he's not being quite so over the top in some of his more extreme roles. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of my favorite things he's ever done to this day, and it's not for everybody because, again, it's a sort of long form drama series. I think it's like over almost 40 episodes. But Triumph of the Skies.
Yep, I've seen that one. The first one
is an amazing series. And he's just really, really good in it as this, you know, pilot captain. He's got a good relationship with his parents. And, you know, there's some love triangle-y stuff that goes on, but a lot of it's too about doing his job, and it's just really good. He's excellent in it.
That's where I first saw Jerry Lamb, by the way, in that series, now that I think of it. back in the day, this is ages ago, someone really did a job on the fan subbing of that series. They did the Animago thing of explaining why Jerry Lamb is calling so and so sister, and you know, the titles of respect that people inside, outside the family give to each other. So it was like an education at the same time. So fan subbers, I give it up to you for letting us in. And I was a big Francis fan then too, so I was like, I was hooked. So still have it here somewhere, if the burns even work anymore. But hey. So I doubt if that ever came out as an official subtitle.
Oh no. Yeah, no, it was one of the first, to my knowledge, that was released with actual English subs selectable. And I wonder if it's because they had that whole kind of Australia pilot training school thing going on in there, and because of the international hopping that they did, that they started doing that. I remember back in the time that when it was on air, the technology had gotten to the point where you could actually select optional subtitles for streaming TVB dramas, but only the two primetime dramas. So not to get too deep in the weeds, but basically there's two primetime dramas on TVB 5 nights a week, right? Every night. There's either 8:30 to 9:30 slot and the 9:30 to 10:30 slot. Those are the two big, you know, drama hours, and they'll run for, you know, 20 episodes or 30 episodes. So, you know, 4 weeks or 6 weeks or something. And then the next one will come in and fill that. It was, I guess, around the time that HDTV streaming kind of started that they had been able to embed it so that you could, through your remote on your TV, just choose. Did you want Chinese subtitles, traditional Chinese subtitles, simplified or traditional or English? And then with that series, that might've been the first series, but I can't guarantee that, but that was the first one that got a box set that had English subtitles, and it said very specifically on the front. So yeah, I have that one and some subsequent ones that came out in years later that I wanted to see that I didn't get to watch on TV. So
I remember, not to get too deep in the weeds either, but at one point Francis is doing, he's reciting some English poem or something in English in that series. And it's adorable because, if we're being fair, English is not his strongest tool in his wonderful toolbox. So it was so endearing to see him recite that when all his friends were gathered up. It's like 20, 30 episodes into the series. Maybe they're in Australia by that point. So just remember that, because he can sink his teeth into English if need be. If you remember Gen X Cops, all that foul dialogue that Francis got to deliver. That was wonderful. It was very X-rated, very bad guy, let's just say. About doing stuff to characters' mothers in hell. So it's like, whoopsie daisy, the movie rating went right up. So,
and it's still better than the yo-yo dog in Gen Y Cops.
I listened to the you sit up and listen when Francis talk, and you cover your eyes or cut your ears off when Edison does his yo-yo dog-dog. I'm going to get through that movie one day in Gen Y Cop, so it's the rut of it all, as I always say. That's going to carry me through that movie. Any other notes on Triad Society 2?
If it's one you can track down, again, it's fairly entertaining, although, again, probably not enough character focus for many people, but it's not the worst Triad film that's out there by far. It's definitely entertaining for Francis and his friends.
This was the era of a few of these anti-Triad tropes movies, which I personally do include this one in, but in that company. But you know, you would have Too Many Ways to Be Number One, as I always loved when the Triad characters weren't in control and were the ones that were screwing up big time, and they were pretty much dumbasses sometimes and out of control and sort of children. And that includes Too Many Ways to Be Number One. In the first story, they manage to bury someone in a wall and his beeper is still going off. And it's a wonderfully played gag. In the second story, Francism is different, in a lot more impulsive. And Lao Ching-Wan just simply has to babysit him for a bit in Too Many Ways to Be Number One, just to keep him under control. And I think that's part of the streak of these Triad movies where they started to make fun of it, because that was more entertaining than the stoic stuff that came out of Young and Dangerous. And heck, even War of the Underworld I saw for the first time just recently, Herman Yao's film. Yeah, on the surface, not that different, but I liked that it was so active and so always on the run, and always making sure there was something visually interesting going on, even if it was just about tilting the camera back and forth, push-ins and so forth. Just make it a lively Triad movie, because to be fair, the Young and Dangerous movies, they weren't exactly lively. So it was almost like that was Herman Yao's track of mind and mission, just to don't make it boring, and also cast the best of the best in the most heroic role. So therefore, we got Tony Leung Chiu Wai and Yikin Cheng. Yikin who? Tony has arrived.
The one final bit of sort of movie trivia, just for those who've got eagle eyes when you're watching this film. You will see a certain scene, there's like, as one of the gang crowds is gathering, they're walking by a billboard poster for the film Shanghai Grand. Now, I could be wrong, but I'm guessing that they didn't put that poster there intentionally. I'm not sure. I tried to figure out what theater it was. I know it's a Newport theater. I don't think it was the Dynasty. It might have been the Newport Mongkok, but it was really hard to tell based on, you know, things have changed so much since then. But I'm thinking it might have been the Newport Mongkok.
Do you honestly in your heart think filmmakers put that up by design?
No. Well, I mean, yeah, it's a possibility, but I think more likely they just said, put the camera here, shoot there. That's a poster that's, you know, one of our sister productions, so we're going to give it a little bit of screen time. Again, if it wasn't put there on intent, that means that they were shooting that scene somewhere between July and August, mid-July to early August, when that Shanghai Grand movie was actually running in cinemas. Okay. And this film was released in early September. So that gives you sort of a timeline between, you know, about a month and a half between when they filmed that scene, got everything in the can and edited out and put back in the cinema, and probably in that same cinema they were just filming. So.
Okay, dokie. Thank you, Paul, for we might have discussed back and forth, because I have great admiration for these films, but the intent for this bonus episode was to hear someone else discuss these movies, and I greatly enjoyed hearing your take on them. So I suppose, unless we missed any particular movie, I suppose that's who knows, we might have covered all of the hugely to mildly connected Young and Dangerous films and spin-offs and what have you. We might have covered them all. If not, then I think we have a pretty sizable and thorough coverage, including here in the bonus episode. You know, we got that movie Twinkle Twinkle Lucky Star to watch the fifth appearance by Ugly Kwan for a few seconds, but I'm not sure that's worth an entire podcast, to be honest. So that's us. So quick sign off for the bonus episode. Thank you everybody for taking the time to follow us here to the website and listen to us that way, because this obviously won't turn up in your podcast feed. So cheers for that, and thank you Paul for indulging me, I suppose, and revisiting these two movies. You know, it's not a terrible ache on your day to watch two 90 minute movies across 2 days, you know. So it's not like I asked you to revisit Triumph in Disguise and please do it in 7 days.
Yeah, that would be rough.
You know, full disclosure, Triumph in Disguise movie, not really worthy of the name. Or did you enjoy that?
No, as a matter of fact? Not at all. It's terrible. The sequel series is okay if you're a completionist. I didn't enjoy it as much as the original series, but I mean, it's there and it does continue on Francis's character, you know, Sam's story and sort of his romantic relationship. So that's worth your time. The movie, not at all. Just don't even bother. It's, yeah.
And I'm going to ask a very silly question. Was Lewis in that?
The movie? Yes.
Yep. Yeah. It's like, of course he was in that. What movie are you talking about? Every movie. Yes, of course he was in it. That's why. But that's why we love him as well. Anyway, thank you everybody for listening. I've been Kennedy and with me was Paul Fox. So we're heading out of the Triad Society and doing something else. So take us out, Paul.
I'll see you all next time when my voice will sound like Ugly Quan.